Good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of December 6, 2015. We are thrilled to have you with us, and we've got a great show on this, our penultimate episode of Information Week Live for 2015. We've got one more before we hit the holiday period where we will be off the air for a couple of weeks. And so we've got some special discussions this week and next week. And by saying special discussions, I've just thrown my guests into a tizzy because they had no clue such a thing was happening. But we're all going to have a great time today because joining us here around the virtual conference table, we have Kelly Sheridan, Information Week's expert on all things Microsoft and the world of personal productivity apps. Kelly, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
We also have Dave Wagner, who is in charge of the community here at Information Week, and who also just keeps a general eye on things that are looking into the future for the IT community. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. It's nice to be back after a couple weeks of absence there. Sorry about that.
Oh, we're pleased to have you back with us. Glad to have you hale and hearty once again. Well, wanted to go around the table a little bit and find out what you've been keeping an eye on for the last week. And Kelly, I'm going to ask you first, what was the big story, or was this a week of a big story in IT?
I covered a couple different stories this week. On the Microsoft front, we saw the release of Cortana on iOS and Android. And I also did some stories on Google, which made their life sciences division independent, renamed it. And I did an interesting story on millennials yesterday. Well, I guess I posted today, on how millennials foresee that they will need more IT support in 2016 than baby boomers or Gen Xers. So that was an interesting little tidbit to write up.
That was an interesting thing. And I saw that report. Now, you are someone who is very familiar with the generation that people tend to call millennials. What was your take on that report that the millennials need more technical support? Do you think this is just one of more of the let's say nasty things about millennials articles, or is there something to this?
I think it reflects the evolution of devices in the workplace, because I think more employees, and obviously as employees are getting younger, are starting to use more devices. So you're seeing not only laptops, but more tablets and more smartphones in the workplace. So I think that as more devices enter the workplace, I think that means that puts a little more pressure on IT, that they're going to have more problems. So I think it did make sense to me from that perspective. I also thought it was interesting that when it comes to bringing those additional devices in the workplace, millennials are doing that more often than their older counterparts. For example, the difference between the amount of millennials bringing a tablet into the workplace and the amount of baby boomers bringing a tablet into the workplace was like 30-something versus 18-something percent. So there's a big difference there.
You know, something that when you talk about the more devices, there's a statistic that I have heard a number of times when I have talked to university IT professionals, that's that they look at a student, or for that matter, a faculty member, but someone coming onto campus, they see 7 connected devices per person coming onto campus. And I'm just floored by that number. I see my own little electronic ecosystem, and I can pretty reliably be counted on for four devices. I'm just not sure where the others come from. Dave, I know that this is an area that you also have an interest in. Do you think that the millennials are getting a bad rap, or do you think that there really is something about more and more devices accompanying each person when they come into either the workplace or, say, a campus?
Well, I do think some of it has to do with more devices. I have to say I also think some of that question has to do with millennials' disappointment with corporate IT. Another study that I happened to see, I was going to write about, but I haven't gotten a chance to yet, Microsoft put out a small survey about millennials, and one of the questions on that survey was, for millennials, do you do your own IT and skip the help desk? And millennials, 29% said that they never call the help desk, and which was higher than other generations. So what I think is interesting about that is I think that's reflecting sort of a disgust for the inability of IT to solve millennial problems, right? I think both mean the same thing, right? Some people are saying, well, geez, I'm going to be relying on IT support more because they can't give me the kind of seamless experience I want that I get at home. And some of them are saying, geez, I'm not even going to talk to IT because they don't help me. And not to get down on our IT departments as a whole, I think we're doing a pretty good job. But what we're seeing with consumerization is, particularly millennials, is an expectation for things to be easy. And we have not yet, or at least most enterprises, have not yet gotten to the point where they're making this experience easy. So I don't know if it's I'm going to need the help desk more because I need more help, or whether it's I'm going to need the help desk more because they're not doing these things as well as they could.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I can remember, I admit that I am an atypical user. I can remember a time, it's a decade and a half ago now, but at another publication here at the company that owns Information Week, UBM Tech, we actually set up our own IT group within the publication. We had our own email server, we had our own calendaring, we had our own collaboration, and our basic deal with corporate IT was you're just going to forward everything, and we won't ask you to do more than that, and you won't hear anything about anything we do from us. We promise you no support calls as long as you reliably forward. And that worked for the history of that publication, and I really can't imagine many central IT groups agreeing to something like that today.
No, but they do. But we see it, right? That shadow IT. Except you were nice enough to tell them about it, right?
I mean, very true. This was before the cloud, so we didn't forward to a cloud email service. We actually had a server set up in a rack at a major university that belonged to us.
Right, exactly. And so that's the difference, right? And now the same thing is happening all over the corporate IT world, and it's happening. They're paying for it with a corporate credit card. They're putting it in the cloud, and they're circumventing central IT. And it's not everywhere, but we all know it's happening, and it's happening more and more. I just finished an article that'll be going up in the next couple of days about CIO, the IT forecast for 2016 for CIOs. And one of the things that came up in that tech systems report was that for the first time, a majority of CIOs that they're studying are reporting that they are not the highest spending department on technology in their company. So we knew this was coming. This has been coming for a long time. Gartner predicted this a while ago. But this is the first time where it's happening, that 500 U.S. and Canadian CIOs are saying we're not spending as much on technology as other departments. Shadow IT or approved IT in other departments has taken over.
Interesting. All kinds of things sort of coming together in what seems like it should be a fairly simple story. Now, I know that there are other stories out there, but I tell you one that I would love to get my colleagues' take on. We all know that a week ago today there was the horrific shooting out in San Bernardino, California. And one of the things that has come out of that and out of the earlier incident in Paris is a new push to allow a back door into encryption. We have law enforcement saying that it's just unacceptable that people should be able to fully encrypt things and not allow law enforcement a way to get at them. Now, for me, the problem with this statement is the firm knowledge that any encryption scheme with a backdoor is a fundamentally broken encryption scheme. And that if all transactions that are now encrypted must have a way in for law enforcement, then there is no usable encryption anymore. But I'm curious about your takes on this. Is this the kind of thing that you feel we need to have a trade-off here, or is this something that is just going to continue to be a problem for law enforcement going into the future? Dave, you and I have talked about privacy issues many times in the past. What do you think about this?
Right. Well, I don't want to get overly political because there are two issues here, right? There's a technological side, there's a political side. I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to start the wrong kind of argument here because this is still fresh and there are people who are very hurt by it. So I want to be careful. But my general feeling is that you're right, that truly breaking encryption is what a backdoor does. Because somebody else can find the backdoor then, right? What I would much prefer if I had to do something like this would be saying that with a warrant, somebody who has encrypted something must de-encrypt it for law enforcement. With a warrant and all the normal search parameters that normally fall under that kind of thing. If that would make me a lot happier, because I don't want the government being able to just snoop at will, and I also don't want the encryption to be made fundamentally weaker through the process. That said, it is an interesting situation because what encryption fundamentally does is it says no one, no matter what their authority, can see this without my saying so, which is a little different than the equivalent in the real world non-digital scenario, right? Is I can lock my door and tell the government they can't come in, but with a warrant, they can knock my door down. The fascinating thing about an encryption key is that if I can keep the key secret, the government knocking down the door, if it's good enough encryption, could conceivably take days, weeks, months, and in the process, people could be hurt, right? So I'm a little sympathetic. But I generally err on the side of freedom and privacy over law enforcement and government.
Okay. I think that's a very reasoned position. Kelly, what do you think? Is this something that has you worried in either direction from a technology standpoint?
I think it's interesting because, like Dave just said, technology is bringing on this entirely new level of questions about privacy and security, and I don't think that there's any one right way to address this question. I think the idea of having to unlock information with a warrant sounds like more of a happy medium, because I would agree, you know, you break the encryption in something and that's immediately vulnerable and you don't know who's reading that information or what they're doing with that information. But I would definitely have to err on Dave's side here with sticking with more privacy and freedom.
You know, I'm going to agree with that as well, because this is not, strictly speaking, a new problem. People have, for centuries, used ciphers and codes to send messages that they didn't want others to be able to read. It was done in the era of handwritten letters, just as much as it is today. The difference now tends to be in the volume of communication and in the speed. So while I'm sympathetic to the demands of law enforcement, when I think about everything that is encrypted today, which includes financial transactions, matters having to do with personal identification, medical records, and things of that sort, I think that those are sufficiently compelling to keep encrypted in the strongest possible way, and that in sheer volume, the issues regarding terrorists don't reach that level. So I'm going to tend to come down on the side of strong encryption for the time being. But I know, I am fully confident, that this is one of those things that we're going to continue discussing for a long time to come. I just have that absolute conviction that this is not the last time we'll be visiting this particular issue.
Right. I mean, this conversation is essentially not that different than the conversation we had after 9/11, which is what amount of our freedom and privacy are we willing to trade for security? Correct. I mean, that's ultimately the question, because you're saying, hey, I don't want Paris to happen again. I don't want San Bernardino to happen again. That's great, and nobody does, well, other than the bad guys. But to make that not happen, if giving up all of your freedom, which I think in a way giving up your encryption does, that's a question of whether you really want to trade that off. Because if you're saying every encryption that's designed by any good person can be viewed by the government without a warrant, you're basically saying all communications in the country and probably a large percentage of the world are readable by the United States federal government. If you're willing to do that, that's fine. That's the decision you've made. That's the trade-off you made. But let's be really clear about that trade, because it doesn't take too many pieces of information that you're encrypting to put together to essentially reveal your life.
I absolutely agree. I think this is one of those cases where the three of us are generally in violent agreement on this subject, which tends to make for boring radio. It would be much better, as we've learned from the cable news networks, if one of us truly loathed the other two. But there you have it. This is one where we're just entirely too reasonable. And if reasonable conversation is what you like, then this is the place to be. So we're assuming that you like the reasonable conversation. And let me take just a moment to remind everyone that we would love to have your voice in this reasonable conversation. If you're listening live, we appreciate it. And there is this great live chat that takes place online when we are live with Information Week Live. That happens 3 p.m. Eastern every Friday, and we would love to have you as part of this. I mean, we appreciate you being one of our listeners on an archive format. We are glad to have you, but would love to have you live as well and have your voice in the conversation. Well, speaking of conversation, I want to move to the next one. And Dave, before the show started, you and I were talking about stories, and you mentioned one that might not seem to most people to be an obvious IT story. And that has to do with a couple of chemical industry giants who have, after years of dancing, it seems, decided to get together. So tell us about this story that you're bringing today.
DuPont and Dow Chemical have announced one of the biggest mergers in the history of the United States. It's a $165 billion deal. It makes Dell and EMC look small. and I think a lot of people think of DuPont and Dow as, you know, they're big in agribusiness. They're big in materials. They've invented things like Teflon, right? But what's fascinating about that is I don't think people realize how much DuPont and Dow are involved in products that are part of IT, printed circuit boards, material science for devices. The outside of your Lenovo computer is made by a Dow chemical. There are other wearable devices. There are surfaces on your devices that are made by one or both of those companies. LED lights, solar panels. They're into pretty much anything you can think of in technology. So while I think the larger percentage of the attention to this deal is going to be played out in agribusiness and in some of the other arenas where the monopoly is larger, we need to pay attention to these two companies coming together because chances are it's going to take out a little bit of competition. And when you take out a little competition, sometimes that affects pricing. You may see circuit boards, printers, devices, all sorts of things become slightly more expensive because of this. And that's something to pay attention to. Now, Dow and DuPont promise that after the merger, they're going to spin off into three separate companies and that those companies will compete to a certain degree. But I don't think it's quite the same thing as what DuPont and Dow are doing now, which is competing directly on price and other issues. And, you know, on the other hand, there are people who are looking at Dow and DuPont merging as a good thing because it will allow them to compete more directly with international companies that are larger and have more economies of scale, like BASF. So, depending on who you are, this is either good news or bad news, but it is absolutely IT news, which I'm not sure a lot of people really understand yet.
Well, there's a lot wrapped up into this. Now, I like the fact that you drilled down directly into some of the vertical markets where there are going to be questions about this. Now, Kelly, I want to turn to you. Is this a story that you were aware of? And if so, what do you think about this? Is this the kind of story that reaches into IT from perhaps an unexpected direction, or is this the sort of thing where we should be looking more at these stories so that we can anticipate some of the price and cost issues that are likely to be cropping up in the next year or two?
I actually didn't know this story didn't pop up on my radar until Dave just mentioned it. I think it's really interesting that you pointed out how this is indeed an IT news story, because I feel like most people who hear about this news will immediately think, oh, what's going to happen to the chemical industry? But in terms of how I first reacted, I think this reflects an overall trend that we're seeing. I don't know how relevant this is, but I was speaking with someone on the phone the other day who mentioned how the PC industry is going to go through the same kind of mergers and industry exits even over the next year because of competition. So not sure how relevant that is, but that is what first came to mind when I did hear this news.
Well, it's just like GE calling itself a technology company now, right? Jeff Immelt got up on the stage at Gartner CIO Symposium and said that they're a software and analytics company. What's fascinating about this is that if you make anything at all related to a chemical of any sort, or if you make anything related to an industrial capacity, at this point you're interlocked with IT. I mean, you know, we have the old hat saying technology. You know, every company is a technology company, but this is true now, not just from a software perspective, but actually from a hardware perspective. The consumerization of IT is meaning that products we wouldn't ordinarily think of as IT products are becoming so. Internet of Things is making that so. Your smart coffee maker is now an IT product. It's not a technology product. It's not just a coffee maker anymore. It's going to become increasingly true that we have to pay attention to companies we never thought we would pay attention to before, as technology companies, as technology stories, even when they make physical products that you don't think of ordinarily as IT.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned these companies that you don't normally think of, because I can recall being at CES a couple of years ago and talking with a VP at General Motors, and I was stunned to find that he told me that for virtually all of their new cars, more than half of the value of that new car, if you look at the dollars and cents of the components, is bound up in software and intellectual property. You know, for General Motors, automobiles are not primarily an assembling of steel and aluminum and plastic. It's primarily a rolling clump of IT that happens to be surrounded by steel and aluminum and plastic and rubber. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating, and it's something that doesn't seem to show any signs of slowing down.
No, and it wasn't a GM that sued to say that they owned the software in the car and that you couldn't modify it. You couldn't do anything to it other than what they wanted you to do to it. Is that correct?
I think it was oddly General. Enough, the company that launched that particular lawsuit.
It was John Deere, wasn't it?
It was John Deere regarding the tractor.
my apologies to General Motors.
Yep. I can imagine companies doing that, especially, and here I'm going to be just brutal to someone. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see Volkswagen doing something like that, because obviously they're a case of a company that is in the process of losing huge dollar amounts because people did go in and do some reverse engineering of their code.
Right.
And
the only way they wouldn't do that is if they decided that the bad press was worse than the advantage from the lawsuit.
I'm not positive that the press could get any worse for Volkswagen, you know, without involving, you know, human sacrifice in Stuttgart or something like that. But I did think it was interesting that recently the Librarian of Congress, who is charged with interpreting and enforcing copyright issues, has said that people can, in fact, continue to look at and modify the code that comes inside, wrapped up in vehicles. And I think that, you know, obviously there are more lawsuits to come. But I think it's amazing that the Librarian of Congress has to weigh in on the contents of an automobile's ignition system.
Right.
Seems something that wasn't wrapped up in the original job description.
Right. Well, it used to be, when one owned a car, that generally speaking, if one were trained a little bit and were near a pretty good parts store, one could jack up their car in their driveway and essentially modify and repair a car in any way they wanted to. With the advent of computer software in the car, it's becoming increasingly harder for somebody to do those same home repairs because they're no longer just physical. They require access to the computer and the diagnostics. What's interesting is, I don't know if either of you noticed it, but Verizon this week launched a product that I think is pretty fascinating that allows you to plug in to the diagnostic port of your car, and it will send you reports on your car and its functioning as you drive. Their claim is that you will be able to save on big repair bills by seeing small fluctuations in performance before they get too bad. And that is something which may help hobbyists, and it seems like it's part of a tradition of allowing people to modify their cars in their own driveway. So it's kind of nice that the Librarian of Congress and should I say Verizon are sort of supporting the idea that the car is still something you should have access to. You paid $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for it. Maybe you have the right to open the hood and see what's in it.
Well, it's interesting, as you say, cars are much more complicated. I see both sides of that because I have a 20-year-old pickup truck that I tend to do all of the work on and a one-year-old Prius that I do essentially no work on. I think the ultimate in the users do nothing has to be BMW, because I believe on some of their models now, they don't even provide a way for the owner to check the oil level. If you want to check the oil in the car, you have to take it to a dealer.
That's great when the car is new.
To me, there's just something inherently wrong about that. But then again, you know, I'm the resident old guy Luddite on the team, I suppose.
No, the problem with that is when the car is 10 or 15 years old and it has small oil leaks and you want to increase the length and the lifetime of that car, checking the oil is a necessity. The first 5 or 6 years of a car's ownership when it's under warranty, generally speaking, you can assume it's not leaking oil at a rate that you need to check it between oil changes. But that's planned obsolescence. That's a hope to get BMWs off the road faster, and I don't think that's a good strategy.
Well, I think once they get old and start burning a little oil, as long as they provide a way to pour in a bottle of motor honey that will last for the 2 weeks until you can sell it, then things are pretty good. Well, I hate to say it, but we have run through our allotted time. And, Kelly, I hate to – it seems like we haven't heard it nearly enough from you this week. You've been very quiet. Is there something that you desperately wanted to talk about that we just haven't gotten to this week?
No, not really. It's actually really interesting hearing you guys talk about the Verizon Auto thing. I don't have a car, so I don't know much about how they have evolved, but that's definitely an interesting space to keep an eye on. It was a pretty quiet week on my end, especially in the Microsoft department, but we will see how that changes in the weeks to come. You know, they always kind of keep me on my toes.
Well, speaking of staying on your toes, now I have to tell everyone that all of us are going to be getting together in New York in the coming week, where we have a chance to actually sit down face to face, which is wonderful. But wrapped around that, we have to continue to keep up with all of the goings on in the IT industry. And so I'll start going around and ask Kelly, what are you keeping your eye on for the coming week? Anything that you're going to be frantically looking at while we're avoiding hearing what the executives have to say in our meetings?
Well, I am looking forward to seeing the team, but other than that, I will be working on a story on Microsoft predictions for 2016, kind of trying to see what everyone is thinking they'll come up with next year. So while I don't have my eye on any specific topics in the news cycle, I will be doing some digging on that. So looking forward to it.
Very good. And remind us again how everyone can keep up with you on a regular basis on all the social media sites.
I really like Twitter. You can find me at Kelly Sheridan. Last name is Sheridan 22.
Very good, and we will absolutely do that. Kelly, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Dave, turning to you, what are you casting your steely-eyed gaze upon for the coming week?
Well, I will have my annual Geek Holiday Shopping Guide, which is, I think, always a fun read, I hope. If it's not, then tell me. I'll do better next year. But we've got some fun things, including my personal favorite, which is a combination aquarium herb garden that uses advanced farming techniques to allow you to create your own little environment that the symbiotic relationship between the fish and the plants you're growing above, which is a very cool thing. And I'm going to be working on a story about, there's a study that shows that about half of us feel like we're so busy we can't even use the bathroom, which I think if we actually feel that way, we really, really need to rethink the way our work lives are designed, which I think should be a fun story.
Well, I think if you're not employed on an assembly line taken straight out of an I Love Lucy episode, then you really are right. There's no reason to be so busy you can't take care of biological functions.
Yep, and, you know, even if you do work on that I Love Lucy thing, at least you get to stuff candy in your face. So
that's true.
That's at least a consolation for not getting to go to the bathroom.
Well, Dave, I know that you stay pretty much chained to your desk full time keeping up with this. So how can people follow you in your frantic online news gathering lifestyle?
Well, they can sit next to me on the couch since I'm chained to it. they can follow me at GeekendDave on Twitter. That's weekend, but with a G, GeekendDave.
We will certainly do that. Dave, thanks for taking time out of a busy day to be with us here on Information Week Live.
Thanks for having me, Kurt.
And as for me, I've got a slideshow coming up looking at Python and why Python is the language you learn to love next. I've got some more slideshows coming up in the coming weeks, still putting those together, and also have a two-part article coming out on user groups in 2015 and why they're still important. Would love for you to follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Find me on Periscope at that same handle. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Curtis Franklin and follow me on Facebook at that same name. Well, we will be back next week with our last show of 2015, and we're going to take a little bit of a look back and also going to be asking our panelists about what they want for Christmas and what they see coming up for the year ahead. So please be with us next week. We'd love to have your comments on those in the live comment section and have you chime in on what's going to be important for IT in 2016. Well, for Dave Wagner, Kelly Sheridan, and all of us here at Information Week Live, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it. Wouldn't do it without you. And, hey, we will see you next time.